Great. All right, so you said that your job involves a lot of microphones and stuff. How would you describe your job?
Well, I'm officially the president and CEO of a fairly substantial not-for-profit organization. And what I'm about is growing mission capacity here and organizing the right level of finance and talent and capability to be able to make positive change in communities. Mm-hmm. We're kind of a unique goodwill in that we offer services to lots and lots of different kinds of folks. And goodwill sort of traditionally have been about employment and training for people with disabilities and other barriers, whether it's poverty or whatever. Mm-hmm. But our goodwill has launched out into the Harmony Cafe program, the American Indian Center, a whole host of other kinds of service offerings that are not typical to goodwill. Mm-hmm. And we're a pretty big organization. We have 2,000 employees and a budget of $60 million, and we have a big, hairy, audacious goal of being able to touch 100,000 lives with a $100 million budget, and we're kind of on our way to making that happen. Mm-hmm. So that's what I do. I'm responsible for leading and developing strategy and creating vision and growing leaders and teaching, coaching, and mentoring. And at this stage of my career, I spend a lot of time just trying to grow the next generation of leadership to make sure that this mission is sustainable over time. So the microphones and cameras thing is because I sit in the first chair, and so whenever anybody wants to talk about goodwill or what we do or how we do what we do, mm-hmm. I'm always the guy who's on point for that.
Right. So in terms of trying to develop new leadership, what do you mean by that and what does that involve?
Well, I think there's an evolving new kind of development in not-for-profit work, and that's social enterprise. It's running businesses that support mission, and that's kind of what goodwill is all about. So when I think about developing leaders of the future, I don't think about developing people who run charities. I think about developing people who run social enterprises. Mm-hmm. So they have to have business acumen and capability and a big heart and interest in mission, right, and then merge those two. So when we look at how goodwill is structured, we look at ourselves as an enterprise-driven, mission-integrated organization. Mm-hmm. And one of the advantages that gives you is that you create your own capital for mission. And that's real different from being on the street with the alms cup and the sort of traditional charitable model where, right, we hope you'll give us some money so we can do nice things. We're way more in control of that. And that gives us a lot of latitude that other organizations may not have, because we can make decisions that might be controversial sometimes, mm-hmm, and not risk losing funding and a whole host of other things. So we're way more independent, I think, because we're an enterprise, than if we were in the old charitable paradigm and model. So when I think about growing leaders of the future for human serving kinds of organizations, I'm really invested in the notion that the organization of the future is all about enterprise, and then taking the enterprise capability, the talent of the people, the treasury that you create, and so on, and using it to do good work in community.
Right. So does some of your work relate to LGBTQ?
Yes. Yeah.
Right.
Well, first of all, Goodwill's first corporate value statement is we put people first. Mm-hmm. And so when you say something that bold, it can't be we put people first, dot, 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 all except for these guys. And so we end up working with a lot of people that are not popular, mm-hmm, in society. People returning from incarceration, people who have been sexual predators in the past. And I'm not lumping LGBTQ into that group of people. But what I am saying is that we've created the opportunity here to work with groups that other people tend not to be too invested in. Mm-hmm. The other thing is we have a lot of LGBTQ folks who are part of our team, and we want to honor them. And so we've got domestic partner benefits, and we welcome them into this community of caregivers. And so we do it because if we weren't doing it, we wouldn't be true to our values and we wouldn't be honoring our mission.
Mm-hmm. How does that fit into the community here? Or let me rephrase that. What is this community like in terms of LGBTQ civil rights?
Well, let me first define our geography. We
Yeah.
operate across 35 counties of Wisconsin. So we're in La Crosse, Tomah, Menominee, Eau Claire, Rice Lake, Wausau, Marshfield, Rapids Point, Antigo, Rhinelander. So when we look at our community, it's all of those communities.
Right.
But if your question is specifically geared at what's the Fox Cities like,
mm-hmm.
the Fox Cities is a really interesting place.
Right.
It's really conservative, but it's very progressive. And there's a nice combination there. And I think on some levels, our job is to help the community express what's in its heart but not often articulated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of people here who care deeply for people and who don't want to see people hurt or damaged in any way, but are masked by the sort of conservative nature of the community, their religious beliefs, and a whole host of other things. So we've sort of taken upon ourselves to position, through the Harmony Cafe as an example, to create a place in the community where civil, reasonable conversations can happen between rational, decent people who may have disagreements. And so a big part of the Harmony Cafe thing is to just elevate issues in community and explore and expose those issues in ways that people can grow and learn. We also have, through the Theta Care organization, this thing called chats. And we just went through an LGBTQ chat where we invited community leaders in. We did a whole day immersion into all of the issues surrounding LGBTQ stuff. We had a transgender person come and chat. We had local religious leaders talk about different religious perspectives on the issue. We went to the high school and had kids in the school who are part of the GSA chat with these community leaders. It was a very powerful day. And the net result of that is that now there's this whole kind of effort on the part of the community to do better by this issue,
mm-hmm.
and to find resources and opportunities to become more open and affirming and welcoming. So it's a very, you know, we're also the home of the John Birch Society, so you kind of, you know, you have to imagine that there's this enormous polarity in this community of opinion and diverse thinking about issues. We've been blessed with a board of directors here at Goodwill who are not risk averse and who get it and who have allowed us to take this organization places that I think a lot of boards maybe would not have, or somebody would have said, wait a minute, time out, that's stepping a little too far. Off mission, and our board has never done that, and so we've had complete support. You know, we have a youth program for LGBTQ people, and we just had the gay prom, and we've had drag shows at our Harmony Cafe program, and
mm-hmm.
our board has sort of muscled their way through it. And when you go back to the community ethos, I know there are people on our board that are struggling.
Yeah.
But they also are mature enough to say, this isn't my fight. You know, this is a place where I think we need to go to make the community a healthier place. And what always happens is that people surface who say, you know, I never told you, but my brother is gay, or my daughter is a lesbian, or this or that or the other thing. And you start beginning to understand the turmoil that they're in and the churn that's going on, because they want to love a family member, but they're also sort of been oppositional where this whole issue is concerned because of their business life and their position in the community and a whole host of other things. So I would say we're kind of evolving and growing here.
Mm-hmm.
And what Goodwill contributes to that process is a safe place to do that.
Right. And how long have you been working with Goodwill in this capacity?
I've been here 21 years now.
Wow.
And before Goodwill, I was an executive for 20 years with the Association for Retarded Citizens Movement.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, I was a teacher. And before that, I was a campus radical. And before that, I was involved in the civil rights movement in the 60s in Chicago. I worked in Cabrini.
Right. Are you from the Fox Cities area?
No, I'm a Chicago kid.
Yeah? How long have you been?
Well, I moved to Wisconsin. I married a Wisconsin woman and moved mm-hmm. to Wisconsin when our children were born, when I was about 23, and I've been here ever since. I had a
mm-hmm.
six-year stint in St. Petersburg, Florida, leading the Pinellas Association for Retarded Citizens program.
Mm-hmm. So how have you noticed or how has Wisconsin or the Fox Cities changed since you have been here?
Well, when I first arrived, it was spooky.
Yeah.
You know, I was a Chicago kid, and so I couldn't find any food that I liked. I couldn't find people whose faces were different. You know, this was, when I moved here, was the late 1960s, early 1970s, and this was primarily a Northern European part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So if you wanted anything ethnic, as an example, you had to go to Chicago or Minneapolis to find it, because it just didn't exist here. In fact, the only African-American folks who were here were people who worked for the Packer organization. And then the only other ethnic group were the Oneidas, the Native American folks. So it was primarily white, primarily Catholic, very conservative, and I felt really out of place, you know, being a Chicago kid and coming into this environment. And the change I've seen is really refreshing, because you can drive around this community now and get wonderful food and exposure to wonderful cultures, and we've got a multicultural center, and so, and now about 17% of our population is non-white, and so it's been really fun to watch that happen. And one of the things that I've really kind of enjoyed is that we can do it right here. You know, Chicago is Chicago, and they did a lot of things wrong. You know, they built Cabrini, and they built the Robert Taylor homes, and they segregated populations, and they did a lot of really horrible things. Here we had the chance, because it was an evolving opportunity, to get better at integrating people socially and culturally than trying to figure out how to fix Chicago. So we could be proactive here and not reactive. And I think that's been part of our journey, is to try to set a stage for the notion that we can continue to diversify and do that in a really neat kind of way that builds community and doesn't create silos and barriers and stuff. So we've been working really hard at that kind of structure.
Mm-hmm. How has that affected the experience of LGBTQ community members, do you think, over time?
In my mind, the way I frame it is, it's almost like one of the last frontiers of civil and human rights.
Mm-hmm.
And it's waited a long, long time. That community has waited a long, long time to be welcomed and appreciated and loved and cared for. And I think their situation is very much like the 1960s civil rights movement. And so I think we're not anywhere close to where we need to be, but we're better than we were. You know, I grew up generationally in a time where there was no open discussion about being gay.
Mm-hmm.
There was no open discussion about diverse thought and opinion. You know, it was just not how America worked at that point in time. And I think what's happening now is that you've got differences of intergenerational influence and opinion right now, where the older generation is still living kind of where my parents and I grew up, and they're having to begin to think differently, because there's an openness now around LGBTQ that there wasn't before, and so their grandchildren and their, you know, their sons and daughters are now a big part of their life, and they're having to figure that out. So they're sort of churning. And when you go to the other end of the spectrum, your generation and the generation that are now my grandchildren are just not getting it. You know, it's
mm-hmm.
like, so what's the deal? You know,
yeah.
Why would you do something that stupid? And so what I see is this sort of churn going on, where people are kind of coming to grips with the idea that there are living among us people who behave differently, who have different aspirations and interests and proclivities, and what we need to do is celebrate all of those differences and not be afraid of them and not look for biblical passages that, you know, denounce them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where I think we are now. I think we're in the middle of the churn. I know I was really active when the marriage amendment was happening in Wisconsin, and I had two perspectives on that. I was leading the regional economic diversity committee for economic development, where we were celebrating Richard Florida and saying we need to be an open and affirming community to attract the best and the brightest and all the rest of it. But my colleagues at the table who were business people were not interested at all in having us go out against the amendment.
Right.
So I was like the Lone Ranger. You know, I'm running around with my little business hat on and I'm trying to say there's a business case for diversity and this is a bad law and it's discriminatory and all the rest of it. And at the same time, there was this big conflict inside of business leadership saying, well, we may have in our human resources language the notion that we support LGBTQ and we have domestic partner benefits and so on, we're not going to get involved in this fight.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the real challenge of the time. And so I think that we're still not there. You know, the fact that the state has that amendment breaks my heart. Mm-hmm. It makes it uncomfortable for me to live in Wisconsin comfortably because I think it's just the tyranny of the majority.
Yeah.
You know, had you put civil rights to a vote in Louisiana in 1960 and said, let the people decide if they should be able to go to the bathroom or, you know, sit at a lunch counter or drink from a drinking fountain, you wouldn't have had civil rights. It was because the federal government stepped up and said, just can't do this anymore, gang. States' rights don't apply here. You know, the Constitution says the right to happiness and this whole thing is just wrong. It's wrong-headed, but it's hard. It's a hard fight because of the cultural incapacity to deal comfortably with gender issues and sexuality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you mentioned when you were younger that this just wasn't something that was like on the table,
right,
or wasn't something people talked about.
Yeah.
Can you remember like any, when did you first become more aware of LGBTQ rights or?
Probably in adolescence.
Yeah.
You know, when I was growing up and when I was becoming sexual, it became really apparent that there was a whole universe out there and we weren't just in touch with it because it just wasn't mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I got off to college and realized there were all sorts of different people on the planet, that was the awakening, and that was the time when it became really clear that there was a subculture in the country that was trying to do its best to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And my nature is to want to be nurturing and to want to affect change that makes life comfortable for everybody who's here. And all through my career, it's been getting people with disabilities integrated into the mainstream culture and, you know, getting African Americans integrated into the mainstream culture. And I think now, for me, this is sort of the capstone fight.
Yeah.
You know, this is the place where you sort of knuckle down again and say, you know, this is like the 1960s, it's just a different group of people and a different humanity that we're fighting for, who aspire to be loved and cared for and fully included and
mm-hmm.
and honored in our culture.
Yeah. Where did you go to college?
In Chicago. Well, I went off to the University of Illinois right out of college and had a terrible year. I loved beer and guitars at that time. And so when I finally finished my year at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana, the only two things I passed were ROTC and fencing. So I went back to Chicago and my dad put me back to work in his printing company and I worked in the bindery for about 2 years and then decided there was more to life than that. And so I went to a little liberal arts college called Kendall College in Evanston, Illinois. And Kendall at the time had a sort of a reputation for picking up wayward young people and trying to repair them. And so I ended up there and I got an associate degree at Kendall. And then I went on to a smattering of other institutions. I did a little time at University of Illinois Circle Campus, University of Chicago, Roosevelt, and then finally graduated from North Park College in Chicago on Foster Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And during that whole time was the 1960s, so it was the civil rights issue and it was the Vietnam War issue, and I was engaged in both of those
mm-hmm.
In terms of anti-establishment activities.
Yeah. and you sort of mentioned that there were these other kind of communities that were kind of struggling, or
yeah.
In what ways did they struggle, or in what ways did they survive? Like, what were
The
the,
LGBTQ community at that time?
what were their.
Well, they were way underground, you know, that was the first thing, and it was a behavior that was an unmentionable. And the second thing was that they had strategies that they deployed to connect and to be present with one another. You know, there were bars in Chicago that people would frequent where there was LGBTQ kind of activity going on. A lot of it was closeted stuff, you know, it was just when I'm alone at home, in the privacy of my home, I can be who I am. And so that's how people survived. It was, they went underground. There was very little sort of radical in your face stuff going on. And, you know, Christine Jorgensen, as an example, was the very first transgendered person who appeared anywhere. And that was probably the late 1950s, early 1960s, and that was hugely controversial. And then Renee Richards came out, I think, in the 70s as a transgendered person, and then went on to try to become a female tennis star, you know. And so you were beginning to see little things beginning to happen, and people having the courage to become public with their lifestyle. But I think that the difficulty remains today that we still haven't arrived at that place where people can be comfortable in their own skin and be able to express themselves like from early childhood on. Because, you know, we still segregate jump ropes and baseballs on the playing fields at elementary schools. And you walk through the toy departments of stores and there's the boys' toys and the girls' toys. And so we're still cranking on, wanting to believe that there's a dichotomy, a black and white dichotomy in gender issues and in sexuality issues, and we're still teaching that. So when you imagine this generation of little kids moving out, even though your generation is getting more progressive, that whole generation of little kids are still spoiled by really horrible marketing. And so it becomes a real issue. And it's an issue that's probably out several generations now because we still haven't come to grips with the notion that little boys, if they're tender, should be able to do things that we believe little girls are privileged to do, and little girls who are athletic can be like little boys. And until we get to that place where we permit folks to simply be who they are and who they are most comfortable being, this issue's going to live for a while yet. You know, I because I'm an old civil rights guy, I thought that we had changed and shifted patterns of behavior a lot around African American and racial issues until Barack Obama became president. And then all of that old crap that was below the surface burbled back up again, the birther deal and the, you know, is he really an American deal, and you know, the horrible kind of cartoons that were going around that were so demeaning and terrible about Michelle and about Barack Obama. And here's the way I kind of conceptualize it. When you think about what happened in Eastern Europe during the Soviet Union, when it was still the USSR, they suppressed those Eastern European countries for almost 100 years. And as soon as the suppression was gone, they went back to the old hatreds again. The Christian Muslim hatreds in Bosnia and Herzegovina had been boiling underground for 100 years, but the only reason they didn't surface and become an issue is because they were repressed. The Soviet government would not permit them to exhibit their anger. And in some ways, the issue here is that our social norm of being polite inhibited people who were still bigots. And as soon as the lid came off of that with President Obama, all of that old crap just sort of burbled back up again, and we saw people, as a lot of people in my generation, just being ugly again. And so my sense for the future of this whole movement where LGBTQ folks are concerned is that it's probably 6 generations out or 7 generations out before we're finally loving one another right.
Are there any sort of incidents in this community that kind of brings those issues to the fore.
Sure, we've had suicides here among teenage gay kids.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in the city of Kaukauna, that's been a major focus of people's concerns here. We still have bullying that happens in our schools. But I think clearly that we're doing a better job here than other communities are in terms of trying to be present with the issues and having community leaders really sort of come together around, are there solutions, are there better ways to do this?
Mm-hmm. So Kaukauna,
Where is Kaukauna?
Yeah.
It's part of, if you look at the Fox Cities on a map, they're kind of up in the northern tier. It's called the heart of the valley.
Okay.
So at the southern end, you've got Neenah, Menasha, Appleton, and then Kaukauna, Little Chute,
mm-hmm.
Combined Locks, that whole little cluster of communities up at the north end. Kaukauna is an industrial town. It's been around for years and years and years, driven mostly by the paper industry, very Catholic community.
Mm-hmm.
But for whatever reason, there seems to be just a real kind of propensity there for kids to be leaving the planet.
Yeah. So in these, when these kids commit suicide, what has the community response been like?
Well, we're sad.
Mm-hmm.
From a goodwill perspective, we've been happy to have the Harmony Cafe because the Harmony Cafe has become almost like a quiet, safe breathing space for people who are mourning. A number of the kids who've died are kids who were Harmony kids,
mm-hmm.
and who had a connection to the Harmony Cafe. And so we've had post-wake gatherings at the Harmony Cafe for kids that have been a part of our life and are no longer. And the Harmony Cafe is one of the places where we have those safe conversations about this stuff and try to help people come to grips with some of the darker sides of our communities.
Mm-hmm. What was the media response like? Or,
well, I think the media is sensitive to it. The media has done pieces on bullying. The media has been kind of engaged. But have you seen the movie Bully yet?
Not yet.
Okay, there's some stuff inside that movie where you see the sort of tension in the school system,
mm-hmm.
around, was it really bullying that caused
right.
this happen, or was this bad parenting? You know, there's that conversation going on.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a little of that churn and mix here that, you know, people have not had the opportunity to kind of talk through it to a place where they arrive at a shared view of what caused this young person to decide to take their life. And so there's not clarity yet around what exactly is it that caused, like, I think it's now 5 or 6 kids in the Kaukauna school system who
wow.
died.
When was the first, do you remember when the first incident was?
No.
No.
I've lost track.
Right.
You know, when you get to 5 and 6, it starts to become a blur and not a very pleasant blur.
Right. And what about politicians? Has there been any sort of like political response?
Well, we have some really solid political leaders here. Tim Hanna, who's the mayor of Appleton, really gutsed it out in this last round with domestic partner benefits for his employees.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a lot of opposition from the city council. So we have a thing here called Toward Community. It's a group of people who care about civility and decency, and we have a Martin Luther King Day, and then we award a community member who has shown, you know, exceptional courage with the McCarty La Chapelle Award, which basically says, way to go, you know, attaboy. And Tim was the recipient of that award this year because of the kind of courageous stance he took on that. The city council is clearly divided around this issue. The counties haven't come forward yet with any kind of real energy around, we need to treat people more fairly.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got some big corporations here too who are, Kimberly Clark is an example, and Procter & Gamble, and our organization, and Theta Care, who have all come to the table with domestic partner benefits and such.
Right.
But the political community here is a really conservative community,
mm-hmm.
and are just not grappling with this issue. with any real clarity. In fact, it's sort of like, it's just like the state today, it's polarized.
Right. Right, so you mentioned the Harmony Cafe, and you've been involved with the Harmony Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
How did that start?
There's a young man named Shannon Canavan. I think you may, thanks, Shannon sort of referred me to you.
Mm-hmm.
Shannon was working for the Boys and Girls Club, doing LGBTQ stuff with the Boys and Girls Club. And a group of local young people were getting together fairly regularly with Shannon as their kind of group leader. And out of conversations in that group, it became really clear that there were a whole bunch of kids living in this community who didn't feel safe, who didn't feel like they had a place where they could congregate, who didn't feel like there was an alternative to the typical teenage stuff here. And so they started encouraging Shannon to do something differently. And Shannon and a young woman took a trip to Madison, and on the way back home, she said, you know, we really need to have some kind of safe place to gather and to be together and to support one another and so on. So he popped in our door one day with this idea that he needed some support for this concept of inclusion and working with kids who were gay and lesbian. And we just had a conversation, and I said, you know, that's kind of right up our alley, let's talk. And so in the beginning, it was kind of like a virtual thing. We used the library for places to meet, and then a coffee house in town said, you can have us for Friday night, and we'll close our doors to other people, and you can bring your group in. So over time, it became really clear that there were a lot of kids who wanted this kind of experience, and so we just finally said, let's get a home,
mm-hmm.
and we rented a piece of property and started the program. I think that's probably 6 or 8 years ago now that we started the Harmony Cafe. And then we got some good website stuff going and some good social media stuff going, and we got kids talking to one another, and we started doing events, and we started a couple of GSAs in the high schools, and the next thing you knew, it was a program. And so then a couple of years ago, we thought it needs a permanent home, you know, and we bought two buildings down on College Avenue, and then built another Harmony Cafe in the Green Bay Market,
mm-hmm.
and gave it a permanent place in the Goodwill family of stuff, and have been at it ever since. And here in the Fox Cities, because we're more associated with Appleton and Nina and Menasha, we could lead the work here because I was present, Shannon was present, our board was present, and we could kind of work it. When we went into the Green Bay Marketplace, we were a little bit more sensitive to that's even a more conservative place than here. And so we took a whole year before we rolled out our strategies in Green Bay to just warm up the community. We didn't want to sort of come in like the thundering herd and, you know, shake everybody up and have them get really angry with us right away. So we contacted community leaders, and we did what I would call a genuine civil rights grassroots kind of movement led by Shannon and Jesse and Deanna and their crew. And in a really lovely kind of way, about a year ago, we had a breakfast and we invited all these community leaders in to tell them what our agenda was and where we were going with this. And we had the chief of police and the mayor and the county executive and high school officials and kids who were LGBTQ all in this room. I think there was close to 80 of us.
Yeah.
Had a breakfast and kicked it off and had the mayor stand up and say, you know, this is the right thing to do. And and it was really kind of fun. So now we're comfortably positioned as a leader in that community, and I think people understand that we've got a good heart about this. Still may not agree with us, but at least know we've got a good heart about it. And so our energy around that was to just continue to demonstrate our corporate values and our sense of mission around having people fully included and caring well for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how that whole thing evolved.
Were there any challenges?
Sure. Patience.
Yeah.
You know, I think the biggest issue was sitting at this table with young people who were really anxious to go, and a little more in your face, you know, and saying, you gotta trust me on this one. I'm an old dog. I know how to do this. You just gotta trust me, and you gotta go slow, and it's not gonna be tomorrow. It's gonna be a year from now that we're gonna have this big party. And I think that worked really well. I think they got that, and I think they went out and executed just supremely on it. And so I think the big challenge was just not to go too fast. We knew what we were about. And I'll tell you what, that avoided a future downstream challenges of people who were afraid of us and got in our face because they thought we were coming in to somehow turn the morality of their community upside down. And so the challenge was to be patient, but I think it avoided certain future challenges that we might have had we been more aggressive and more in your face.
Right. So has the community in general been very supportive and responsive?
Yeah.
Have you ever met with any sort of conflict or resistance?
I get the occasional phone call or email from somebody in the community who thinks we're wrong-headed.
Yeah.
And I always look at those as teachable moments. You know, I can just share back to them what we're about and why we're doing the work we're doing. I know in one of our communities here, I got a call from the mayor's wife, you know, kind of saying, what on earth are you doing and what's this all about? And I had an opportunity to spend some time with her and share some time with her, and she's now a proponent. And so we turned that conversation around. We've never had, you know, I'm always waiting for that goofy group from Kansas to show up, you know, and be really ugly. But we're kind of ready for that. And I think because we've been good at this work, if that sort of thing happened here where we had outside enforcers coming in doing really rotten stuff, I believe this community would rally behind us. I really believe that with all my heart. I have a unique position here. They're permitting me to be authentic. And I lead vigorously here. I've been the president of the Rotary Club, and I've done all the stuff that hotshot community leaders do. And I think one of the things that I found really a gift is that they have said, go do that. And they look to Goodwill, and they look to our board, and they look to our leadership to sort of organize. So, like, as an example, when the hospital group came to talk about, we're going to put a chat together around LGBTQ issues, we were one of the first places they stopped, you know, to say, give us some advice, give us some direction, who would be good speakers, what should the day look like. And so we're positioned now to be, I think, really effective. But a lot of that has had to do with just patience and perseverance and going slow and recognizing those teachable moments and working those really hard. You know, my wife and I were on vacation and we were traveling, and I got the phone call, and it was one of the young guys on our team who said, we're doing the gay prom and we've got a basket full of condoms, and you know, da 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 da. And it was sort of like, oh, well, we need to talk. We just have to talk this one through. And now we do that, and there's no issue, but had we sort of launched into that and the gay prom became the time when we were handing out condoms to people whose parents weren't there, I mean, you know, that could have been absolutely explosive. But I think we're in a place now where when we do that, people get it. They understand that we're trying to protect these kids from serious problems in their lives. And so I'm back to your question about, have we been confronted, or the occasional letter, the occasional email, the occasional phone call from somebody who's really upset. Interestingly enough, the most controversial thing we've done in recent time is we put up a billboard that said, drop your pants at Goodwill. And I got more phone calls on that billboard than any of this stuff. And it was mostly from women my age who just didn't seem to get it and thought we had overstepped our bounds.
So if you had tried to open up something like the Harmony Cafe, say, you know, 20 years ago.
Not a chance.
No? What do you think?
Well, I think you're seeing with the abolishment of don't ask, don't tell, with big businesses offering domestic partner benefits, I think you're seeing a warming up that wasn't there 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
20 years ago, we were still sort of dark aging it. Wisconsin was still fairly progressive, you know, because Wisconsin, I think, was the first state in the union to pass protections for gay people in the workplace. That was a big deal. That made me proud to be a Wisconsin citizen.
Do you know when that was?
Huh? I don't. It's 1970s, 80s.
Okay.
You have to go check the record. So that was a big deal. But just even backing up 20 years, we weren't close to where we are today in terms of being able to do the work we do. It would have been a much harder pull. And a lot of that is because I think the culture is shifting, and media is helping with that to some extent, and I think also public policy is helping with that to some extent. You know, some of the better leading is going on at the federal level and the executive branch, and the local politicians are still
mm-hmm.
not there.
Can you think of any incidents that happened around this area when you first came that revealed people's sentiments about LGBTQ rights?
I don't think there was anything that was like a public bang, you know, like where it made the press or got attracted by the media. But I know there's a movement inside the Fox Cities right now called Voices of Men. Are you familiar with that movement?
No, I'm not.
It's a male-driven movement to reduce domestic violence.
Okay.
And the people who began the Voices of Men movement started with the notion that there's this man box, you know, and men behave very poorly toward one another. And so 20 years ago, what I was sensitive to was that there were a lot of off-color jokes, there were a lot of faggot kind of stuff, there was a lot of that's so gay kind of stuff, there was a lot of, what, you know, you're acting like a queer, you're making me nervous kind of stuff. So it wasn't like there was this big overt episode that happened where everybody went, oh my God, you know, this is not healthy. But there was a tolerance for,
mm-hmm.
on a cultural level, being comfortable with that kind of language. And so one of the things that the Voices of Men teaches is that people who really care about issues around domestic violence or violence in general need to understand that what promulgates that is a social acceptance of that kind of behavior and that kind of language. And so this Voices of Men movement is now doing a lot of teaching and training in the business community and helping people understand that at the core of domestic violence are wounded people who are wounding other people so they won't get wounded in the future.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So when HIV/AIDS became a big issue,
yeah.
kind of in the 80s nationally, how did that play out in this area?
For the longest time, my sense is that Wisconsin denied that it was an issue. And then the public health people started piping up and saying, you can't deny it anymore, here's the map. And here's the incidence rate, and here's the incidence rate by sexual orientation. And so then it became really clear. But you know, if you go back to the 1980s, the Reagan administration did not want to deal with the issue at all.
Mm-hmm.
Just didn't. And on some levels, I wondered sometimes whether that wasn't just a clever way to make gay people go away, is just let them kill themselves off with AIDS.
Yeah.
That's a really dark thought, but I think somewhere in the politic of it was this notion that this is God's will, this is God's plan for how we get rid of these folks.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of that was in the DNA of Wisconsin, and especially the conservative parts of Wisconsin. But I think, like anything else, when it becomes your son or your daughter, or it becomes your nephew, or it becomes your brother, the whole thing starts to shift, and people start to understand that this is a personal issue. This is an issue that I have to deal with as a caring father and a caring brother and a caring mother. And so I think that's when the evolution toward sort of a greater recognition and understanding started to happen. My worry now is that because we've got so many pharmaceuticals that can deal with AIDS fairly well, that we've gone back to some behaviors that just are really spooky and scary.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I saw a recent round of statistics that suggested that it's on the rise again, that
mm-hmm.
That people are sort of saying, well, if I get AIDS, I just take the pill and I'm fine, and that's not healthy either. I also think in this country they viewed AIDS as a homosexual disease, a gay disease, and the reality is worldwide it's a heterosexual disease, and we haven't come to grips with that issue yet here.
Mm-hmm.
But I think on a public health level and on a community education level, we're better in Wisconsin than other places are who are denying sex education in high schools.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're a bit ahead of that curve. But my worry is, in the current political climate, we may be drifting into that kind of thinking politically, and that scares the hell out of me.
Mm-hmm. So do you know if within the high schools here they're giving HIV/AIDS education?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we are through Harmony as well, and the public health people are as well. So I think we're doing okay.
Mm-hmm.
Not as, you know, culturally we're still not equipped to have conversations about our sexuality. We just aren't, and nobody's comfortable with it. And
mm-hmm.
so, until we get to a place where we can talk maturely about these issues in a kind of values neutral place.
Yeah.
We're gonna struggle for a long time yet, I think.
Yeah. So you mentioned a couple times that people end up getting invested in these things when somebody they know
mm-hmm.
Is affected. Is there anybody in your life that has had a really big influence on your activism within LGBTQ civil rights?
Well, not in my biological family,
mm-hmm.
But you know, I when I was becoming in Chicago, becoming a person in Chicago, I tended to be on the music, art, and theater side of things. So a lot of my friends were people who were dealing with issues in their lives around their sexuality. And you know, just being present with those folks and watching the struggle and looking how difficult it was and how many of them had been abandoned by their families and you
mm-hmm.
know, those kinds of things was a real issue. In my biological family, I had a grandfather who I'm certain was gay and expressed that by molesting a lot of his grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that was my exposure to different behavior in our family. Was
mm-hmm.
that we had an errant grandfather who just, and you know, my guess is had a lot of the folks who've offended in the past, had they been in an environment where they could be who they were, would probably not be offenders.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a guess. I don't have any data to support that, but I think that that's, you know, what influenced me. But at the core of it is this, I grew up in a family that really somehow molded me in a way that I became responsible
mm-hmm.
and felt that what I wanted to be doing in my life was making the world a better place for people. And you know, and again, that goes back to the all people, so you can't separate that very well. It's just in how you grow up. But I had a ton of friends growing up in the dark ages, you know, it felt like dark ages compared to today, who were struggling and dealing with issues and abandoned by their families and
mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes behaving very badly because they were in a bad place. So that's kind of what my sense of it is about. And my passion for it now is that, again, going back to an earlier part of this conversation, I see this as the last vestige, the last big deal in civil and human rights. And if we can crack this one, that'll go a long way to making the world a better place.
Mm-hmm. Are there some organizations that you can think about in the community that have been particularly active in trying to encourage that happening?
Well, I think the school systems have done, now when I say school systems, some better than others, but the Appleton school system, for an example, I think has done a really credible job of being good about this issue and being healthy about this issue. The Theta Care organization has been really good about this issue. They did the chat group. Our organization, I think, certainly has been in the center of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think to a certain extent the business community has been pretty good, but they've been pretty good in fits and starts. You know, there's
yeah.
not a, we're not Austin, Texas or Madison, Wisconsin here. You know, we haven't arrived at a place yet where it's a part of the ethos of the community. We're still struggling with that issue.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the ones that I think are exemplary.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the business community, I would identify Kimberly Clark and
mm-hmm.
And others as being really credible leaders.
So what is it that Kimberly Clark has done?
Well, they have affinity groups inside of their corporate structure, and they have a chief diversity officer, and they pay attention to the fact that they're a global company and they need to be
mm-hmm.
Thinking globally and appealing to lots of different populations. So it's a business case for them as much as it's sort of a moral case, because they see people consuming their products and realize that, you know, gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people have a big budget, and
right.
they want their market share of that budget. And so they've built the business case, but I don't want to denigrate it to suggest that that's the only reason they're doing it. I think they have some really talented leaders
mm-hmm.
who get the idea that this is the proper thing to do. So there's an LGBTQ affinity group inside of Theta Clark, inside of Kimberly Clark. And there's also African-American affinity group, Latino
mm-hmm.
affinity group, women's and leadership affinity groups. And so they understand that there are people who are still suppressed
mm-hmm.
and need support and need to create an authentic voice for themselves. And I think they're really capable around that.
Mm-hmm.
And Clorox, as an example, is another organization that does a terrific job with that. We don't have a strong Clorox presence here, but one of my daughters is a director at Clorox in Human Resources and has shared with me a lot of the stuff that they're doing. You know, they were recognized by the transgendered community as a transgender-friendly corporation,
mm-hmm.
and so there's some very cool stuff going on.
Mm-hmm. What about Theta Care? What is Theta Care, and what are some of the things?
Theta Care is a health group. They run Theta Clark Hospital and Appleton Medical Center and a whole host of clinics, and they're one of the major. I think they may even be now the largest employer in the Fox Cities.
Mm-hmm.
And their interest is in just being a very competent, capable community health care provider. One of the things that used to be interesting about Theta Clark Hospital was there was a doctor there named Dr. Schrang who performed transgendered surgery,
mm-hmm.
reassignment surgery. And so for the longest time when he was practicing, this was the place where people who were transgendered came to have reassignment surgery happen. And that he tried to pass that practice on to other surgeons and wasn't very successful, unfortunately. So now the new opportunity is in Colorado
mm-hmm.
with Dr. Marcy, I'm blocking her last name, but she's a transgendered physician who is doing sexual reassignment surgery. So Theta Care has always had kind of a progressive attitude around these issues. And again, continues to. They're a very powerful community leader here.
Mm-hmm. What about the Appleton School District? You mentioned that they've been really good too.
Well, if you were to visit a couple of the schools, like West is an enormously diverse school and does a really nice job of working with young people across lots of different diverse backgrounds. East High School, I think, is maybe about to become a charter school. But when you go into East, it just is splattered all over the high school that we're not going to let bullying happen. We're not going to let people be offensive. We're going to honor our students who are different. I mean, they've done a really remarkable job of creating an environment where I think kids feel safe. We had an opportunity during that chat to meet with some young people who are students. And I asked a couple of them pretty much straight out, you know, do you feel like it's completely happening here yet? And the answer is still no.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the answer is as much as the administration tries to create the environment, it's still the kids who come and and are tough with one another. And so there still is work to do. But when I look in on the Appleton School District and their leadership around making certain that to the extent possible and practical, they're creating safe environments for kids, I think they're doing a really credible job.
Do you think there's a moment where they started doing that, or have they?
I think it's been gradually coming on. You know, just the population demographics have created part of that shift. You know, we were like pure white for the longest time, and now we're 17 or 18% non-white. And so we have some schools in the Appleton District where it's like 60% non-white. That's a huge shift in this community. And so as that stuff shifted, we had some very enlightened leadership here. A guy named Dr. Tom Scullin, who passed away recently, was one of the principal leaders in warming this community up to educating all kids well and not, you know, not being fussy. I still think within the school systems, and I'm not going to suggest that this is Appleton or any specific system, there still is a big issue around how we integrate kids with disabilities. We're not doing it well. And what they're, and it's polarizing because, you know, in school politics and in school budgeting, it's those damn special ed kids that are costing us all this money, and if we didn't have to deal with that, you know, we'd have all kinds of money to do stuff with bright kids, and that conversation is still happening. And so there's a lot of work yet to be done around integrating people who are different.
So in terms of openly trans or gender queer people in the community, is there, do you think that there is like a trans or gender queer presence, or is there, are there openly trans and gender queer people in the community?
Yes. A handful. We employ about three folks who are transgendered, and we're changing all of our bathrooms now to unisex bathrooms to accommodate that. We had a, we actually had an issue surface where a well-intended store team leader didn't handle it very well, and so we're fixing that now. So that's just sort of becoming an issue in our community where people are starting to get sort of sensitive to it. There's a woman at Lawrence whose husband is transgendered, and she wrote a book, My Husband Betty. It was sort of out in the bestseller space for a while. And he was, she was the person who came to speak to the chat group about transgendered issues and so on. So it's surfacing. But we've also had the other side of that where there was a transgendered person who was causing some real hassles at a bar in town here. And that made the papers in a sort of negative kind of way, that, you know, this person was being pushy and demanding to go into a woman's bathroom and caused the bartender some issues and, you know, those sorts of things. So I think when you look at the order of things, like if you were to rank order how folks, how far folks are from being fully included, that's the last bastion, is the whole issue of transgendered stuff. And gender queer stuff, and that's a tough one.
So this incident in the bathroom, or this incident in the bar, could you describe that a little bit more about what happened?
Yeah, there was a transgendered person who was attending a bar in this and needed to go to the bathroom and went into the woman's bathroom, and somebody really got irate about that, and the bar basically threw her out. And said, you know, until you're ready to go into the right bathroom, you can't come in. And that got to be kind of a big deal, you know, and it made the press, and she sued, and, you know, a whole bunch of stuff happened as a result of that that kind of surfaced the issue. But, you know, this area is not a hotbed of transgendered culture. It just isn't. And on the positive side of things, going back to the Goodwill experience, the Goodwill in San Francisco had an opportunity in the Castro District to get a boutique building. And so they went out into the community and found out that there was a real need for a transgendered boutique and hired transgendered people to run it. and good, it's a Goodwill program, and it's a place where they sort out clothing that's sized properly for people who are transgendered and has the right kind of fashion appeal and stuff. So when you go to a community like San Francisco, you see a higher elevation of the issue because there's a higher population density of people who are transgendered. But here it's just not, it's not surfaced big time yet.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the issue, again, going back to this notion of politeness, is I think because the woman who's here who has a transgendered spouse is a Lawrence professor,
right,
evokes all the polite stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it while it's kind of a learning experience, it's not totally a learning experience yet, because I think on some levels people just don't come to grips very well.
Mm-hmm. So this professor, her husband transitioned to a woman?
Yes.
Okay. Do you know what happened ultimately with this trans woman that was at the bar, like in terms of she
yeah,
sued?
The city, you know, sort of came in, and the legal guys came in. And as I understand it, it was finally resolved.
Mm-hmm. Right. Do you get a sense of what the community response was to that?
I don't. I don't.
Yeah.
There was nothing that was sort of in my space that I could
talk
to about that.
Mm-hmm.
I know it was just a hassle for people here to think that, you know, there's an element in our community that longs for the good old days.
Yeah.
You know, that says, gosh, you know, Appleton used to be a place where you could leave your keys in your car and not lock your front door and not bump into anybody who was different from you, and they loved that.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the older leadership here still longs for that time.
Mm-hmm.
But that time is long past. And so, you know, my best take on how the community responded to that whole issue is that it was a variable response. You know, there were some people who went right on, you know, there were some people who went, oh my God, you know, there were some people who went, because I think of all of the human behaviors, that's viewed as the greatest perversion by people who live on the dark side.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember when that happened? Was it?
That incident?
Yeah.
A couple of years ago.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So you also mentioned that domestic partnership has recently been kind of a big deal in Appleton.
Yeah.
What has been the history of gay marriages, domestic partnerships, or gay couples in this community?
Starting with gay marriages, there are a group of clergy people who would do commitment ceremonies, and outside of the legal context of marriage, would marry people. And that's been going on for a good long time. A fellow who was the chairman of our board and also served as our corporate chaplain, John McFadden, performed a lot of gay commitment marriages. Dottie Matthews, who's on our team as corporate chaplain now, was the associate pastor at the Universalist Unitarian Fellowship.
Right.
She's on the Goodwill team now. She
mm-hmm.
performed a lot of commitment ceremonies, and she's openly lesbian. And so, recognizing that Wisconsin does not recognize gay marriage,
mm-hmm.
the commitment celebrations were happening, but the sort of legal standing hasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we're still in that netherworld of, you know, neither fish nor fowl nor good red herring, where that whole question of committed relationships and marriage is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
But it's happened here, and it's happened a ton. You know, there are some very enlightened clergy people here who understand that, you know, monogamous, healthy relationships are good
mm-hmm.
and act on that impulse.
Right. How have you experienced being an advocate for LGBT issues? What has your experience been like?
I think there are people, as I try to work in this community, who honor the work I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
and that feels good. When the marriage amendment thing was going on, it happened to sort of correspond with Day of Silence, Night of Noise.
Mm-hmm.
So I became a Day of Silence community business leader and went through the whole day passing out cards saying why I wasn't talking. The reaction that I got was mixed when I did that. You know, there were some people who thought I was just being completely ridiculous, and there are other people who got it. And then we had a celebration in downtown Appleton where we talked for the first time, you know, at like 6:30 that night about our experience during the course of the day. I have this theory that I got from another guy. There was a gentleman named Dr. Mark Gold, who was a professor at Carbondale University of Illinois Carbondale, who did a lot of work with kids with disabilities. And he actually created a model for teaching and educating and training kids with disabilities called Try Another Way. And the theory was, it's not about the learner, it's about the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And if the teacher's persistent enough, they'll figure out how the learner learns. And so Try Another Way was kind of his clarion call for thinking about education of kids with disabilities differently. But he had this thing that he called his competency deviancy hypothesis,
mm-hmm.
where kids with disabilities are concerned. And he said, the more we can have them appear to be competent and actually be competent, the more people will embrace and be okay with their idiosyncrasies.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a practitioner of that model. And I think because I've been running an organization that's moved from serving 300 people to serving 50,000 people, that's moved from a $6 million budget to a $60 million budget, who's been a community leader, I get cut a lot of slack because I'm a competent, capable community leader, and so they permit me to present a little differently, and they permit me to be present in all of the leadership activities in the community. So I've been blessed, frankly, with being a leader in this community, because when I turned 60, I gave all of my suits and ties and coats and shirts to Goodwill and kind of said never again, and then said, if I'm going to be really true to this work, I need to be authentic. I need to be able to be who I am in this community, and started that journey. And that's been good and healthy. I mean, it's been really healthy for me because I just go about my life,
mm-hmm.
and I do that in a really unencumbered kind of way. And I'm still respected and regarded. I'm a sought after speaker. You know, people want me in their presence. And so I'm in a really privileged place right now to be able to kind of manifest myself as a human being, but then additionally to be able to provide some really strong leadership around some really important issues. So I'm happy as a clam. You know, I'm in a very, very good spot right now.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that you, in some ways, are, it seems like perhaps you're some ways in a privileged position in your ability to do this.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think that if you were not in this position, that things might be different?
Yes, no question.
Yeah?
You know, just being alive and understanding how people treat one another, there's no question that it would be different.
Right, in what ways?
Well, I'll give you sort of the really odd dichotomy. I ride a motor scooter around town quite a lot. And last summer I was riding my motor scooter through town and a group of kids pulled up next to me and did the whole faggot thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got shot in the back with what was either a BB gun or a pellet gun.
Oh my gosh.
So when you look at sort of how the host community works,
yeah,
that gives clarity to your question.
Mm-hmm.
I live in a place where, because of my rank and privilege, I'm permitted in certain circles of society to just kind of be a part of the world. But then there are other places in this community where the hatred still lurks and where the darkness still happens, where they don't know who I am. You know, I'm not Bob Peterson, president, CEO, Goodwill. I'm just a guy on a motor scooter who presents differently, and they take a shot at me. You know, so that's the clearest answer I can give you to that question.
Mm-hmm. Are there parts of town or areas of town where that is particularly.
This was right on College Avenue.
Right.
I mean, I was driving, it was, you know, College Avenue, for God's sake. And there are no places in this community where there's like ghettoed up people, you know, so there's no sort of tough parts of town like Chicago, you know, there's certain places you wouldn't go after dark.
Mm-hmm.
But this is not, that's not, in fact, we were just voted one of the 10 safest communities in America.
Right.
And greatest places to raise kids. And so that dark side kind of thing in larger metropolitan areas just doesn't exist here.
Mm-hmm.
But the human behaviors exist here. And that's the stuff that we have to keep chipping away at.
Right. So in what areas or what LGBTQ issues have you seen the most change in your community?
Again, going to sort of a rank order thing, and this is pure observation and not data.
Mm-hmm.
I think lesbian women leaders are doing really well here.
Mm-hmm.
I think gay community leaders are not doing nearly as well, but are doing okay. I think bisexual people just don't even, they're not even visible because they work the world differently. And for transgendered people, I think there's still a long, long way to go. So
mm-hmm.
that's how I would sort of rank order the way the community is responding to folks and how successful people have been. There's a number of people who lead in this community where the community knows full well that they're somewhere in the LGBTQ spectrum, and they're honored as leaders, and they're respected, and they do great work, and they're partnered with other people in the community. Not
mm-hmm.
not partnered, but partnered collaboratively in business with other people in the community
mm-hmm.
and do very nicely.
Mm-hmm.
I also think the fact that we have a gay prom and 70 kids show up,
yeah.
you know, is pretty cool. That couldn't have happened 10 years ago. The fact that, you know, a goodwill organization, a charity, holds a drag queen night is huge. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And our board people showed up and had fun. You know, I mean, that's a big deal. So I think there's some really cool stuff going on, and I've seen some really good things happen. But again, I think there's kind of a rank order of how people are accepting folks.
Right.
And so that would be my observation.
Right. So you mentioned lesbian leaders seem to be doing quite well.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any examples of?
Well, I think Dottie Matthews on our team here is a respected community leader and does really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
There, at Kimberly Clark, a senior vice president is an openly lesbian woman and is really respected in the community and has done really, really well. So there's real clear examples of people who are lesbian who are really accepted in the business community and held with very high regard around their competence and not their sexual orientation.
Mm-hmm. Great. Are there any sort of LGBTQ issues that you think will undergo the least amount of changes?
Yeah, I think for the moment the transgendered thing is going to not be easy.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be the last bastion of this work. I also think, too, that as people become less and less afraid to exhibit themselves, to choose the kind of clothing they really want to wear,
yeah.
you know, that's going to be kind of a sticky place for a while people are getting accustomed to people with piercings and tats and different hair and different uses of makeup and men with fingernail polish and
mm-hmm.
you know, all that kind of stuff. We're not there yet where people are kind of openly authentic
mm-hmm.
As a general rule. And so I think that's going to be a sticky place going forward for a while yet too.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole trans thing I think is really going to be tough.
Right. What sort of strategies do you think will be useful in?
One of my big disappointments with the marriage thing was that more gay and lesbian and trans people didn't get engaged.
Mm-hmm.
It was other people leading their effort.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a huge disappointment to me when people that I know in this community should have been engaged economically, should have been on the street, should have been, you know, kind of out there. In other words, it's sort of like when you go back and reflect on the civil rights movement, you had Martin Luther King and the Reverend Jesse Jackson, you had public figures leading that civil rights movement. You don't, outside of people like Tammy Baldwin and
mm-hmm.
Ellen DeGeneres and, you know, people that are sort of stars, the average gay and lesbian person doesn't engage in their own civil rights very well.
Mm-hmm.
Little bit happens with you know, the larger organization at the Wisconsin state level, but not here. And I think that's really an obstacle to getting this thing pumped, is the lack of participation on the part of people in the community to engage in trying to forward the effort.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a real challenge.
Do you have any idea why that might be happening?
Well, I think people are still afraid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a different kind. There's not the same critical mass as there was in the civil rights movement, where you could get 20,000 people to show up on the mall in Washington
mm-hmm.
to listen to Dr. King give the I Had a Dream speech.
Mm-hmm.
You can't gather that many people in one place for it to look like it has bulk, you know,
yeah.
that it, like it's a real movement. And so allies have to sort of step in and do some of that work to make the crowd bigger. But right now the crowd's really kind of tiny, and as long as it's tiny and behaves in a kind of timid fashion, it's not going to get the kind of legs it needs.
Mm-hmm. Is there a pride parade here?
Yes, in the Green Bay. We haven't had, I don't think we've had one here in Appleton yet, but there's a big pride parade in Green Bay.
Right. How long has that been going on?
A few years,
mm-hmm.
maybe five.
Have you been to those?
Yeah.
What are those like?
Happy, healthy. The community gets spooked a little bit.
yeah.
But yeah, they're good. They're good.
Mm-hmm.
When you said, you know, it's sort of like, what do leaders have to do to push this forward differently? One of the problems is the sort of stereotypical behavior of people in gay pride parades, as an example.
Mm-hmm.
That's really off-putting to the general population. So in my mind, one of the real challenges is to get people who are just leading lives,
mm-hmm.
raising children, having families, being who they are, to be present. Because the image that the community has is the one that comes sort of pumping out of the gay pride parade experience. And that's what scares them. You know, if it's a grandmotherly type who says, you know, I've been living with my partner for 40 years now, and starts to talk about her life, that's heavy. That's big stuff. And I think that's part of the challenge right now, is that it's the stereotype that's driving the public perception of the movement, and not normal, ordinary people who are just trying to go about their lives and
mm-hmm.
be who they are in terms of their sexual orientation and just sort of lead normal lives. And so that's what makes this more complicated than other civil rights movements, is that the people who could be most effective are reluctant to come out because they just don't want the hassle.
Right.
They're leading normal, comfortable lives. They have access to all the things they want. Issues around end of life are not a big deal yet, you know. But I'm guessing that as we age that population and they get to the place where estate planning and so on becomes an issue, then maybe they'll get more active and more engaged.
Mm-hmm. What about in terms of adoption? Have there been gay and lesbian couples that have been
yes.
able to adopt children?
Yeah, one of our board members, Aaron Shearer, and his partner have adopted two children in Oshkosh. Aaron's the executive at the Payne Arts Center,
mm-hmm.
and he and his partner have two little boys that they're raising very nicely. So yeah, there have been adoptions here for sure.
Great. And how... have you noticed anything about how, like, the community has responded to gay and lesbian couples that have children and families?
I think really positively. Yeah, I don't think anybody's made an issue out of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on the political side of things, I think that rears its head fairly regularly as another way to abolish a right for people who are gay, is to say they shouldn't be raising children. But I've never sensed any of that here.
Mm-hmm.
I think that people here, again, this is a polite community. They may think in their hearts this is a horrible thing, but they will never say that straight out. what they'll just do is avoid the confrontation and move on. So in some ways it's a pleasant place to be because nobody's ever in your face.
Right.
Because of the sort of politeness of the community.
Mm-hmm.
But every time I listen for feedback around like Aaron and his partner and their children and so on, I get the sense that people, in their case, they've adopted two special needs kids. And people look at that as, you know, wow, what a nice thing they're doing and how healthy that is for everybody. And so I've not sensed any pushback around gay and lesbian people mm-hmm. raising children.
Right. Is there anything that we haven't asked you about that you think is really important to this?
I think you've done a good job.
Yeah?
Is there anything that you haven't pried out of me yet that you think is important?
I don't think so. You guys, do you have any questions?
No, I think you did a wonderful job.
Yeah. Okay, is there anything that you would like to ask us?
Well, I think your work is really important, and I really value the preservation of history. And
mm-hmm.
there was a time when I used to teach history, and now I think I'm becoming it. And so it's really been fun to be with you guys and just kind of share some of these experiences, and I hope somewhere downstream it's useful to people.
Oh, I'm sure it will be. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's been fun.
Yeah. Great.
Okay.
Let's turn these off.
Really interesting.